Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2 weeks ago, Michelle Mahone, a nurse and member of National Nurses United, came on our show to share a very important message. She said that hospitals across the country are unprepared to deal with the COVID-19 crisis. Well, the nurses just issued a new list of demands, which we will discuss on today's show. In the United States, many hospitals are designed to handle peak capacity during the winter flu season, not an outbreak. The United States has only 2.8 hospital beds per 1,000 people. That's according to the latest data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The United States is behind Spain, Italy, China, Switzerland, France, Germany, Korea, and Japan. According to a new USA Today analysis, not one state in the United States will have enough hospital beds to treat patients if the surge in severe cases here mirrors what has happened in other countries, especially like Italy. There could be almost 6 seriously ill patients for every existing hospital bed, and that is a conservative estimate. Joining us now to talk about this analysis is Jamie Fraser. Jamie is an investigative data health reporter for USA Today, and her latest analysis is called U.S. Hospitals Will Run Out of Beds If Coronavirus Cases Spike. Hi, Jamie. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jamie, I want to ask you a question. How do you report on this very important information without scaring people? I'm finding it difficult to balance giving out information without creating fear.
Absolutely. So for me, my job is to help the broader public understand what information their community leaders have as they're making decisions, right? Because if an average reader understands what information their mayor, their governor, their president, their hospital leaders have, it's a lot easier for them to understand the decisions that are being made, but also understand whether they agree with those decisions. And so that's kind of how I've been approaching this, and also encouraging my friends and family to think about when they're paying attention to the news. You know, maybe committing to only reading stories, you know, in the morning or at night, instead of being on their phone 24 hours a day, because that's when it can become really overwhelming.
Right. And that's our job also, to be online constantly to try to make sense of all of this information and then give it to people. And so let's talk about the analysis that you conducted. Tell us where these numbers, because there's so much data in your piece, where do these numbers come from?
Yeah, so I'll just walk you through kind of how we came up with this. Our big question was, do hospitals have enough beds to care for seriously ill patients if we see a spike of cases like there have been in other countries? So we started with a count of hospital beds in every state and in every metro area that's available from the American Hospital Association. And then we had to start making some assumptions about how this disease would spread. We decided to assume that 7.4% of Americans would become infected. That's how many people were infected with the flu last season, or with the lowest level of flu in the last 5 years. And estimates by other groups, including Harvard, have said there could be 20 to 60% of Americans that get infected. We decide to go with 7.4%, which is, you know, kind of a mild flu season rate. And then, we looked at what the World Health Organization and the early research studies out of China were showing, which is that about 20% of people will develop severe or critical symptoms. And those definitions are, you know, severe is shortness of breath, low blood oxygen, you know, acute respiratory distress, which typically means that you're going to need a ventilator, and fluid buildup. People in critical condition also can have respiratory failure, septic shock, or organ failure. So we wanted to narrow in on the people that would absolutely need hospital care at some point. And so that's about 20%. And about 6% of those could be that critical condition group. So that's kind of the walkthrough we did, is we took these hospital bed counts from the American Hospital Association. We looked at populations in the states and what the flu infection rate was. You know, and then we saw how many people could end up needing hospital care compared to the number of available beds.
I think a lot of people are learning for the very first time about what's really going on in hospitals and the dire need for beds and just basic equipment. Like I said, we had Michelle Mahone on our show 2 weeks ago, and she was sounding the alarms then. Jamie, what explains this? Why is the U.S. behind so many other countries?
Well, it's hard to say that we're behind other countries. It's just that we have different, you know, our healthcare system set up differently, our government set up differently, and I don't know that any country has shown that they were completely prepared for this. The reason that hospital capacity can be so tricky in the U.S. is that because we have a private healthcare system, there's a premium on being efficient with all resources, right? So beds tend to be utilized all the time, and the vacancy rate for hospital beds varies a lot around the country, but on average, only about a third of beds are available on any given day, because that's good business. And also, it's, it's just efficient use of resources. But anytime you throw on an outbreak on top of that, it can quickly strain the system. And you're seeing that in other facets too, right? Like available ventilators or the ability to get protective equipment for health workers. And soon we might be seeing shortages of some medicines that hospitals need because a lot of the raw ingredients for those are produced in China or India, which China's been hit really hard by this, and then we might not be producing enough of those. So there's just a tight supply chain and, you know, a tight use of resources on an average day, and we're throwing an extra kink into the system.
So let's go over some of the data in your piece. According to information from the American Hospital Association, the U.S. Census, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the World Health Organization, if the United States sees a major spike in COVID-19 cases, there could be 6 seriously ill patients for every existing hospital bed. So what is being done to tackle that?
Yeah, so there are, you know, 2 major areas of concern, right? You have basic equipment and supplies, you know, whether that's beds or ventilators, and hospitals and states are working to rapidly scale up capacity. So that might mean, you know, surgical centers might cancel elective procedures. And so then you could convert the recovery room into an isolation ward. And suddenly beds that were being used for different types of care could be available for coronavirus care. Or you might have, you know, a larger patient room that you could squeeze a second bed into. And so you see states requesting supplies from the national stockpile. You see requests for, you know, businesses to ramp up production of needed supplies. But a lot of that capacity, you know, it can be increased. The question is, can it be increased quickly enough? Which is why slowing the spread is critical to not overwhelming the system. The second piece of this, though, is the workforce, right? Making sure we have enough nurses and doctors and radiologists and CT technicians and lab workers available to provide care for these patients and for the regular healthcare needs we have. And if healthcare workers start getting sick because they don't have the right protective equipment or they're getting exposed in the community at large, it doesn't matter if you have more beds if you don't have people to take care of the folks in those beds. So a lot of experts I talk to say protecting healthcare workers has to be a top priority.
Well, if you are a healthcare worker and you'd like to talk about what you are seeing, if you want to be anonymous, that is fine. Please give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I've been in touch with a nurse who wrote a long op-ed, and she said, I just don't have time to get this published. So she said, please share this information with your listeners. We've been in contact over the last 2 weeks, and she said it is so crazy out here. There are long hours with a lack of resources and adequate support. She says one takeaway is that clinicians and nurses are still only being given surgical masks for the persons under investigation and positive COVID-19 cases. She also wanted me to share a New York Times piece with listeners. In fact, we got an email about this yesterday. It just came out yesterday. How long will coronavirus live on surfaces or in the air around you? A new study could have implications for how the public and healthcare workers avoid transmission. I'm just going to read the lead because this is really important. It says the coronavirus can live for 3 days on some surfaces like plastic and steel. Experts say the risk of consumers getting infected from touching those materials is low, although they offer additional warnings about how long the virus survives in the air. And this was a study published yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine. And so, Jamie, a lot of doctors and nurses are now going on social media to speak out, to share their personal stories about what is happening. They're also going in neighborhood social media groups.
Yeah, we see that, because of the way we communicate in this modern age, a lot of doctors or public health experts are talking directly to the American public with what they're seeing or what they would like to see, you know, policy leaders and hospital leaders do. But that can also be overwhelming when information is coming from so many different sources. It can be tough as an average person to, you know who to trust or to put things in context. But it's been really interesting to see how healthcare workers have, taken on that mission directly to talk about what they're experiencing.
You spoke to a number of people who run hospitals across the country. What really stood out for you in terms of what they're doing to prepare?
Well, I think most of the people I talked to were infectious disease specialists. So this is, a situation that they talk about a lot in their circles. There are folks out there that are very prepared for this, that they do this for a living. And the challenge is taking their knowledge and making it happen at every level of the healthcare system in the country, where that expertise might not necessarily be found or the equipment could be short. Most hospitals have emergency plans or have surge plans in place before this started that give them a rough idea of, if we need to add extra beds, is there a building that we could convert, So a lot of the questions that we're asking should not be things that hospitals are completely unprepared for. It's just a matter of operationalizing them, actually doing them for what could be the first time in that community. And so I think that's where the rubber's going to hit the road. Is in how quickly they decide to ramp up and if they have the equipment and staff they need to expand capacity.
You also looked at data from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and they estimate that 38 million Americans will need medical care for COVID-19. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So actually, the Johns Hopkins so that they use the same kind of definition that we did of severe critical cases. So the USA Today estimate was that there would be 24 million Americans that would contract COVID-19, and there would be about 5 million severe or critical cases who would need hospitalization. Johns Hopkins estimated there would be 38 million people infected, and 10 million would need to be hospitalized. Harvard's Global Health Institute put out new numbers yesterday, and they looked at several different scenarios, ranging from 20% of people are infected to 60% are infected. And so that their numbers ended up being 50 million people over age 18 in the best case scenario, and three times that in the worst case. So what we're seeing is that, experts are trying their best to emphasize that there are going to be a lot of folks that are going to get sick, and just because we're dealing with a large population, 320 million people in the U.S., even a really small number like 1% or 7% can be enough to overwhelm hospitals at their existing capacity.
And can you give us any updates on equipment and supply chains? Because it is there's a lot of media reports out there now about what Donald Trump told governors on Monday, saying that they should not wait for the federal government to fill the growing demand for equipment that they need. I'm just quoting from the New York Times here. Donald Trump told governors, quote, respirators, ventilators, all of the equipment, try getting it yourselves. Have you talked to any people on the ground, and how are they responding to that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of controversy around that because, public health officials, most of them would think that the national stockpile and, the specialized response team at the federal level, which doesn't exist in the same capacity it did before, they should play a central role in acquiring supplies, because you're going to have more leverage if you can, if you have one person coordinating with manufacturing companies instead of 2,000 hospitals trying to coordinate individually with manufacturing companies, or 50 states trying to coordinate, because then you end up in a situation where the states are competing with each other for the same supplies. That said, because we're such a large country, some folks think it's better that states handle the supply needs and, bans and other aspects of public health, because they can respond more nimbly to what's happening in their local communities. In general, states that have made requests from the national stockpile are not getting nearly as much equipment as they had requested. A couple of states, including New York and Oregon, had said that the N95 masks they got from the national stockpile are actually expired. Most hospitals are not going to be using those because they don't consider it safe. And one of the main challenges with supplies is that a lot of medical equipment used in the U.S. and a lot of manufacturers rely on a global supply chain. So components or ingredients are made in China or India or in other countries. And in the case of China, they have stopped export of some components so they could focus supplies on their own needs during the outbreak. So we're starting to see that reliance on a global supply chain can become complicated really fast when you have a global pandemic.
But before we let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with us that stood out for you doing all of this research?
It's interesting because in some ways I was looking at a worst case scenario, right? I was looking at how strapped hospitals could be if cases spike. But I'm also seeing, a lot of people taking this seriously and staying home if they're feeling ill, avoiding close contact with people, avoiding large crowds. And, it's really hard to be stuck at home for days on end and have your life disrupted, have your job, lose your job or lose your source of income. But I see people taking it seriously, and I see people supporting each other, and that gives me hope that we can get through this. And it might be a long, hard slog, but if we can stick together, maybe it won't be as bad as we're all predicting.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Yeah, have a great day.
You too. Jamie Fraser is an investigative data health reporter for USA Today, and you can find her latest analysis at yourcallradio.org. Her piece is called U.S. Hospitals Will Run Out of Beds If Coronavirus Cases Spike. Now I would like to welcome Dr. James Lawler to the show. Dr. Lawler is an infectious disease and public health expert. He's an associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Dr. Lawler is director of international programs and innovation at the Global Center for Health Security and is director of clinical and biodefense research at the National Strategic Research Institute. Hi, Dr. Lawler. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I need to bring everyone some breaking news from the BBC. Coronavirus death toll in Italy rises by 475 in just one day to nearly 3,000. This is the biggest increase since the outbreak. This is just devastating news. Dr. Lawler, can you comment on this?
Well, it is tragic, and unfortunately, I think Italy had a very late jump on the epidemic in the country, particularly in northern Italy. And, you know, we've seen that this virus has the potential for explosive outbreaks, and unfortunately, the rate of rise is exponential, as your last guest pointed out, and it takes a while for public health actions to catch up. I think many of us are hopeful now that Italy has implemented very aggressive and drastic non-pharmaceutical interventions and social distancing, that will have an effect similar to what we saw in China, but it takes a couple of weeks for those effects to kick in. So if you think about deaths that are occurring now are really reflecting infections that probably happened 3 to 4 weeks ago. So I'm afraid Italy's going to have a rocky couple of weeks before those non-pharmaceutical interventions kick in to full effect.
And Dr. Lawler, I've asked other guests this, but I'd love to get your thoughts. Why did this happen so quickly in Italy? Why are we seeing those huge spikes in cases and also death rates?
So I think what we're seeing is the natural history of this disease in a community that has not implemented those types of social distancing measures. If you actually superimpose the curves from Wuhan and early on in Hubei province in China over what's happening in Italy, they actually coincide pretty remarkably. And so I don't think that this is necessarily different from what we saw in China. It is just reflecting the fact that Italy really only was aware of what was going on and started to act aggressively a week or a little more ago. And as I mentioned, there is a significant lag between action and reaction when you have a disease that's growing exponentially, and the results of actions take a couple of weeks to reflect, just because of the natural progression of the illness.
And because of a lack of testing, we know that in the United States, public health officials have been telling us all week that we just don't have the numbers because of testing. Was that the case in Italy? Is it because they're now able to detect it and people are getting sick very quickly? I mean, can you just give us more information around that?
Right. I think that's the case just about everywhere, and was also the case in China early on. You know, right now, I think that the rise in case numbers that we're seeing, even in the U.S. and in other places, is really dependent on how many tests we can get out there and how many we can perform. I think also the disease is obviously growing exponentially as it does, but what we're really seeing is artifact of test availability, and I think that's what we're seeing in Italy. It's clear that in Italy there are many, many more cases than are currently recognized and counted. They just have not had the testing capacity to be able to get answers on all those folks. And obviously, we're feeling that very acutely within the United States, where it's evident in many communities that there are thousands and thousands of unrecognized cases, but we currently just don't have the testing capacity to be able to find those answers.
Well, again, breaking news from the BBC, Italy coronavirus death toll rises by 475 just in one day to nearly 3,000. So we are thinking of Italy right now. Today, we're joined by Dr. James Lawler, really, and everyone affected by this. Dr. James Lawler is an infectious disease and public health expert. He's associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Today, we're talking about how hospitals are preparing for this crisis. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about how hospitals are preparing for the COVID-19 crisis. And we're joined by Dr. James Lawler, an infectious disease and public health expert. He's an associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And Dr. Lawler, I just want to repeat some breaking news that we're getting from the federal government. The Trump administration is suspending all foreclosures and evictions until the end of April to help those affected by the virus. This is really much needed news, Dr. Lawler, because states like California have really been on the front lines passing this legislation, but I was wondering what was going to happen in other states. And the federal government, I think, realizes that they really need to act now because a lot of people just do not know what's going to happen with their financial situation.
I agree. I think that's great news. We're obviously all concerned about the economic impact of some of the dramatic actions for public health that we have to take. And I think regardless of political ideology, most people probably recognize that this is why we have a federal government to provide unity of action in times of crisis.
Exactly. And Dr. Lawler, I have a question for you about spread. In fact, Carolyn just wrote in and she says, I work at East Bay MUD and they have not set up everyone to work remotely. Right now, I am observing two coworkers talking just 3 feet apart. Of course, one is the supervisor of the other and the other is probably afraid to say anything, although he asked me to keep a 6-foot distance. The supervisor is riding public transit, so one can imagine how this can spread.
So I think it is really important for everybody to keep in mind that we all have an obligation to the rest of the community and particularly to the vulnerable within our communities to try and respect those rules for social distancing. And so maintaining 6 feet distance so that you're outside of the range of droplets is important, and it's important to recognize that from what we know of the disease so far, it does appear that people with very mild symptoms and perhaps even no symptoms are still capable of transmitting the disease. And so all of these small actions that we can take individually add up to actually very large and impactful actions across a community, and they're all important. So really would encourage folks to respect those rules of social distancing at the workplace and staying at home as much as possible. And really the goal is just to reduce the amount of mixing that happens in the population so you don't provide the virus the opportunity to spread from person to person.
Dr. Lawler, six Bay Area counties have been asked to shelter in place. I've been trying to stay home as much as possible for the last 2 weeks because I'm taking care of an older person. Can you talk about the importance of shelter in place? We are the first section of the country that is doing this. Scientists say all eyes are on this. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio was on MSNBC last night saying that he's going to make a decision in the next 2 days, but he said get ready for the possibility of shelter in place. So can you please talk about how important this is?
Absolutely. I think that was an important decision and the right decision given the situation. As I mentioned, what we're seeing in Italy is the fact that actions that you take now really don't have their full effect for several weeks. And so what that means is that you're often stuck in a position of taking actions that may seem disproportionate to the situation, because what you're really seeing is the situation that happened 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. And by the time you're really able to see the full effect of what's been happening in terms of disease transmission and progression of illness in people, at that point it's too late. And so what we know is in communities that have widespread community transmission, which I think we have good evidence that places like Seattle and the Bay Area and potentially New York City now are starting to experience, that if you don't take actions immediately take very dramatic actions to limit the spread of the virus in communities, that the repercussions you'll see weeks down the line can be profound. These are actually lessons that were learned from studying the 1918 pandemic, comparing different cities that had very different experiences. So kind of the two that are held up as models are Philadelphia, which had a really horrendous experience in 1918, and St. Louis, which experienced a relatively mild epidemic. And the difference in terms of when they implemented aggressive public health actions within the epidemic was about 2 weeks. So St. Louis was about 2 weeks ahead of Philadelphia in terms of enacting those types of measures, and it made a huge impact. And so timing is everything in these matters, and being aggressive and sticking to it is going to be important for communities. And again, it's going to feel to many like we're acting disproportionately, but we're really acting to be able to stay ahead of what is an exponential growth.
We have an email from Wolf who writes, one of Italy's big challenges besides their late start on this crisis is the high fraction of older people. That is making it much worse. And Dr. Lawler, I just did a quick search and found a couple of articles that show half of Italy's young people live with either their parents or with their grandparents.
Right. I think it's true that Italy may have the second highest or the second oldest population of any country. I read that. So that is an additional challenge for them. I think that the interesting societal differences between Italy and much of Asia and the United States is the fact that we tend to cohort our elders together much more, whereas these other cultures tend to have elders living with family individually in households. And I don't know how that's going to play out in terms of how the disease and the epidemic propagates and affects populations. I think what we're seeing in the Seattle area is that when the virus gets into some of these long-term care facilities and nursing homes, that the effect is devastating there. And so it's like having these powder kegs spread out through the community where you have a high concentration of really vulnerable people. So it's kind of unclear whether it's better to have those populations cohorted together or whether it's better to have them spread out with their families as they are in many other cultures. But obviously it presents unique challenges to us that other cultures don't necessarily have.
Well, if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And today we are joined by Dr. James Lawler, an infectious disease and public health expert. Dr. Lawler is associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Dr. Lawler, in addition to the administration saying that all foreclosures and evictions will be suspended until the end of April, they also enacted the Defense Production Act, which allows the president to force American businesses to produce materials in the national defense, such as ventilators and medical supplies for healthcare workers. So on Monday, we just talked about the fact that Donald Trump told governors that they're going to have to find all of this, the masks and the ventilators. But now we see that the federal government is going to allow businesses to produce materials. Can you talk about the significance of this, and are you familiar with this?
I am. It's a concept that's actually been discussed for public health emergency preparedness for quite a while. I think that it's probably a necessary step, hopefully one that will yield important results. I think that it would be obviously much more impactful if this had been something that we had planned for for a good bit of time, and so that we had more refined plans for how you convert production lines for certain commercial products over to serve the national need. So obviously there aren't a lot of ventilator factories that are just sitting fallow waiting to ramp up, and it's certainly not, it's not an overnight endeavor to convert a dishwasher factory into something that can make ventilators. So it's going to take some time. And I think nobody really knows how much time it will be, but I worry that converting over to producing those really critical pieces of equipment may not be able to give us meaningful quantities in time to meet the demand for certainly this first epidemic wave that's going to affect the country.
Dr. Lawler, you gave a presentation a couple of weeks ago, and this is getting attention in the media. And I want to ask you the same question that I asked our reporter that was just on, Jamie Fraser from USA Today. How are you putting together presentations that you know will end up in the media without scaring people? Because, you know, so much of this is, I mean, all of this is new for us. A lot of people are scrambling. There's so much information out there. So can you just talk about how that's going through your mind?
Yes, and that was certainly a consideration. And I think that, when people saw the numbers in that presentation early on, days after I gave it, there was actually incredible reticence to publish those openly. But in my opinion, I think we owe the public you know, the best information we can possibly give them. I don't agree with the, you know, kind of the paternalistic philosophy that we need to spare people from scary numbers. If that's what we really think is a reasonable projection and what we need to prepare for, we need to get that information out to folks. I think we would be ahead of the game had we been a little more transparent with what infectious disease modeling experts and others projected would be a reasonable prediction for how the epidemic would proceed in the U.S. and across the world. You know, not as if I was the only one who'd kind of done the math and run those calculations, but particularly because I was speaking to you know, a group of hospitals across the nation, I thought it was especially important to get you know, the best projection to them so that they could start preparing appropriately. You know, now I think fortunately over the last week there's really been a sea change in people's appreciation for how serious this is, but I wish that would have occurred a month or more earlier.
You know, exactly. I mean, we even behind the scenes really struggled with this because we've been wanting to talk about the coronavirus since December, but there was a lot of racism happening at that time. There still is. And we just thought, well, we need to be really careful about how we talk about this. You know, and even a couple of weeks ago, people wrote me and said, can you please stop fear-mongering? So it's a really difficult one to tackle. So Dr. Lawler, tell us what you found. What were some of the questions you were wanting to answer, and then tell us what you found?
So really, the questions I wanted to answer revolved around what health systems and what political leadership should be doing to prepare. And these are still actions that obviously we need to take, and fortunately I think now are taking. But, you know, it's hard to prepare without understanding what you're preparing for. So if you don't have a planning scenario, even, and I don't pretend to have the most accurate prediction of anybody out there, and I don't think that was the point. The point was to give people at least a good ballpark estimate based on all of the epidemiologic modeling that's been done and looking at how the epidemic has progressed in other places, is to give the best estimate of what scale hospitals and communities should be preparing for. So that was the real purpose, and you know, hopefully I think it was able to capture the attention of some of the folks who were, some of the executives who were in that meeting and who listened, and obviously now I think other events have reinforced that.
So in this presentation, you project that about 96 million people would contract COVID-19?
Yes. So my projection was a community attack rate of approximately 30% within the first 9 months of an epidemic here in the U.S. And so that is actually considerably less than what some other infectious disease modelers are projecting. You know, I think it's important for folks to understand that this is a new respiratory virus for which we appear to have no underlying immunity within the population. And so over the course of several years, it is highly likely that without a vaccine, almost everyone in the world will be infected with this virus.
Wow.
So the first year of that would probably involve one or two waves that would go through various communities to infect a significant proportion. And just based on what we experienced with previous pandemics in 1918 and 57 and 68, you know, that proportion of 30 to 40% is usually what we've seen and experienced. And everybody's hope, obviously, is that as we race for a vaccine over the next 12 to 18 months, we'll be able to produce one in sufficient quantities to produce artificial immunity throughout the population and therefore stop the transmission of the virus. But the natural history of a respiratory virus, which is spread very easily and for which there's no immunity, is eventually just about everybody's going to get infected.
So if everybody's going to get infected, Dr. Lawler, what does this mean in terms of, I mean, obviously you have no idea how long we're going to self-isolate, but what are your thoughts if we're all going to be infected and we don't have a vaccine until, let's say, a year from now? In fact, we just talked about a potential vaccine on yesterday's show, if anyone's anyone wants to hear that, you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Just in terms of societal action, Dr. Lawler, how do you see that playing out?
Well, it's a great question, and obviously one that we don't completely know how to project the future in that respect. I think that what most experts would expect is that we'll have an initial wave of infections that goes across most countries, about every country in the world. And again, that initial wave probably will not get you up to, a high proportion, with epidemiologically what we call the herd immunity threshold. I think that, many of us think that, again, maybe 30 to 40% would be infected in that wave, but that with aggressive community actions similar to what we're now doing, we can at least spread that curve out significantly and reduce the amplitude to spare the impact on the health system. And I think hopefully potentially even reduce the overall number of people who become infected during that initial period over the first 6 to 12 months. Hopefully we will at the same time be setting a world record for the production of a vaccine for a novel pathogen, but I think we can expect that subsequent waves of infection will come if we don't have a vaccine. I think what happens in the intervening period is really the big question. How long do we have to hold very aggressive non-pharmaceutical interventions, and when can we start to let off the brake a little bit to allow normal economic and social activity to resume in some respect? And that is, I think, a question that we're just going to have to rely on more data analysis and experience to teach us. I think it's likely that, for instance, in the summer when school is in general, we may be able to relax some of the other interventions that would allow businesses to kind of return to more normal activity during that period of time. Even for novel influenza viruses, they tend to, be pretty... the activity tends to be much lower in the summer because kids play such an important role in transmission of influenza in the community, and perhaps may play a very important role with this virus. But what happens in the fall when schools need to come back in, I think those are things that we're really working hard to figure out. It may be that we have to do rolling school closures or intermittent school closures, or we may need to continue online learning. I think at this point it's really hard to gauge how aggressive and how long-standing these non-pharmaceutical interventions need to be. I think most experts feel that, the initial clamping down is very important to control the epidemic, and then there's probably a way to relax those various interventions over the subsequent months so that we kind of reduce the overall economic and societal pain, but maintain the epidemic at a slow burn. What you don't want to have happen is have a big flare-up when you relax, especially if you relax these interventions altogether, and all of a sudden there's a significant risk that you'll have the epidemic come roaring back. So it's a little bit of a delicate art, I think, to find how you fine-tune those interventions to get a slow rate of transmission in the community, which you're probably never going to completely eliminate, but prevent the flare-up, which, again, is going to threaten the capacity of the health system.
Dr. Lawler, we have an email from a listener who writes, what is the current thinking of why some individuals are infected but asymptomatic? Is it viral load? Is it immune system?
That's a great question. I wish I knew the answer to that. I think that certainly age appears to be at least one factor that predisposes one to have more symptoms and more severe disease. I think that that the inoculation load may also play a role. So, with many diseases, we know that the more of the pathogen you're exposed to and infected with, the more significant your clinical symptoms are, and the more severe your disease is. So that may play a role. And I have to imagine that individual immunity also plays a role as well. But it does appear that age certainly is a significant factor.
Can we end the show by talking about ventilators? Because this is really important. The Society of Critical Care Medicine projects that 960,000 COVID-19 patients in the United States may need to be put on ventilators at one point or another. But the United States has only 200,000 machines on hand. And according to reports right now, there are 62,000 in hospitals. On Tuesday, Dr. Fauci, the Trump administration's infectious disease expert, said the stockpile has about 13,000 ventilators. So what are hospitals supposed to do about this, Dr. Lawler? What are they doing?
Right. That's a huge problem and a vulnerability that we've known about since we started doing pandemic planning in earnest back in the mid-2000s and before, honestly. I think there's a couple of things that the health system can do. First and foremost, the most critical factor is, are we able to control disease spread in the community through these non-pharmaceutical interventions? By doing large-scale shelter-in-place, closing schools, social distancing at workplaces, all of those things, can we tamp down transmission within the community so that our peak of severe disease and people requiring ventilators is low enough that the current health system capacity can absorb? So obviously that's the main intervention we can do to spare the healthcare system. I think certainly there are going to be places where those interventions are not sufficient to allow the health system to meet kind of normal capacity. And then that's when hospitals and health systems have to go into contingency and eventually crisis mode. There are other alternatives to traditional ventilators that we can use. There's non-invasive ventilation with BiPAP machines and CPAP machines that are just masks that can be used to augment ventilators. There are actually folks that have been using 3D printing devices to allow ventilators to ventilate multiple patients in parallel. So one ventilator can actually service two or three patients at a time. There are, some other techniques that we can try and use to stretch the capacity of what we have. Eventually, we hope that we don't see that, but eventually we may end up in situations similar to what Italy is experiencing, where they are actually having to ration the use of ventilators to patients that they think have the highest likelihood of survival. I pray that we don't get to that point, but I think it's certainly something that the hospitals and physicians need to be preparing for. How do you make those decisions in a way that's certainly ethical and consistent with best practices?
Well, Dr. Lawler, I know that you're very busy right now, and we really appreciate you taking the time to share this information with us. Thank you so much for all of the work that you do, and we would love to have you back.
Yeah, thanks. I'd love to be back, and if I can, I'd like to just send good wishes to BW and family and all of you who are hunkered down in San Francisco. Our thoughts are with you all.
Well, thank you. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you so much. That is Dr. James, you too, James Lawler, an infectious disease and public health expert and associate professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. You can find links to the presentation that he recently gave to find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. And I'm really sorry if you heard some noise. I'm actually hosting from my kitchen and there's some really loud hammering going on. So I'm really sorry about that. Thank you so much for joining us. We are here for you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar.